On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, the Boston Red Sox cannot lose. Will they ever lose again? 13 in a row for a team that we thought was done and dusted. We talk about what has been behind this ridiculous resurgence. Then we chat about the Shohei Ohtani injury news. His left knee hurts him. He will not be pitching for the foreseeable future. Does that mean someone else could win the NL MVP? Jordan and I actually disagreed on that one. A little bit more AL East chat, and then we fly through all the results from a wonderful weekend in Major League Baseball. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world more volatile than the 2026 Boston Red Sox. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And Jordan, I'm just trying to string 13 good days together.
Aren't we all? Look at these Red Sox go. They started to heat up before the All-Star break, and we were like, oh my God, do we need to talk about this? Oops, ran out of time. We're in Philadelphia. Well, the Red Sox made sure that we were going to talk about them at length, and that is, of course, our opener.
Compartmentalization is survival. In this life, our brains can only hold so much information, can only juggle so many different thoughts at any given point in time. And so what we do is we push things out of our brain space, whether that is the name of your seventh grade math teacher or the hotel room number that you had a year and a half ago. We choose to forget these things so that we can focus on what matters. And that is how I felt about the 2026 Boston Red Sox about a month ago. There is so much going on in the baseball universe that we think about, that we care about, that we focus on, that we spend time on, that I just didn't have the bandwidth for these people. And yet, we are now in a situation where we must re-engage and reconsider the reality that is standing right in front of us in the form of 13 consecutive wins. The Boston Red Sox cannot lose.
The Red Sox have now mopped their two biggest division rivals. I don't know how the Red Sox-Rays rivalry compares to the, you know, Yankees-Rays rivalry, which has certainly become a lot spicier over the last decade or so. But they mopped the Yankees. This was really the start of this turnaround. It was a little bit before, does not include this 13-game winning streak. But, you know, we've talked about the Red Sox plenty and how dysfunctional they are and how much of a mess they are. And that extends back to last year. But, of course, the peak of that this year is firing Alex Cora in April, right? I mean, you saw that up close. They make the decision to move on from Alex Cora. That was on, what, April 25th, I believe? Saturday, April 25th was
We were all so much
the
younger
day.
Then.
After they won 17-1 over the Orioles that day. But for a while, things did not get any better. In fact, there was a point where things actually seemed to be getting even worse in June. You know, the Yankees, beginning of June, it's like, all right, June swoon. The Red Sox, it's like, no, they just suck. We're not talking about any sort of swoon. They're just a bad baseball team. And to your point, we're not going to have to think about them. June 24th, they lose in Colorado to drop a series against the Rockies. That drops them to 32-46, which if that's not, that's a wrap on the season. I don't know what is. And yet they have gone 18-2 since then. They mopped the Yankees at home. They did lose a series to the Washington Nationals right after that. So the Nats got to be feeling pretty good about themselves. But then they go on the road and have an undefeated road trip into the break, sweep the Angels at the Angels, sweep at the White Sox, sweep at the Mets. And now, uninterrupted by the All-Star break, we say, oh, maybe that'll cool them down. Nope, not at all. They return to Fenway Park. And they have a mopportunity, which was also kind of gifted to them by the baseball gods due to a rainout earlier this year. Maybe we thought it would be kind of a tough thing to have to play a doubleheader right out of the break. Instead, it adds to the momentum that they have continued to gather over the last few weeks. They take all four from the Rays. We can recap those games. But to your first point, it is really astonishing. I think we looked at the AL standings and we knew that maybe one or two of these teams could come back from the dead. We've speculated about the Tigers' chances to do that, and they're still sort of trying their best. But now this is not just, oh, they're back in it. They're literally in a playoff spot now and surging towards a division title? ? What are we watching right now? What is happening?
It is really remarkable because part of it is players returning to their level. Quality big leaguers who we like and we thought were good playing better. That's part of it. But there's also just an energy in that place over the last 4 days. And because the Sox went out and kind of saved their season on the road, this series over the weekend was a different energy. It was a different feeling because the home ballpark hadn't gotten to experience good Red Sox, genuinely good, optimistic, inspiring Red Sox baseball in quite a while. And that context is important because at one point this season, the Sox started off 12-25 at Fenway Park. 12-25. They were just like a regular meh team on the road, but they were legitimately abysmal at home, a place that they've played remarkably well over the course of their history. And so for them to come home and not be, you know, daunted by the atmosphere, to not make more of it than it was, and to just beat the Rays handedly 4 straight times was incredibly impressive. And Willier Abreu, to me, is the main character here, him and Wilson Contreras. Abreu is just so freaking steady. And these two represent like different ends of the what it takes to succeed in a cauldron, an unrelenting environment like Boston, where you can either be like Wilson Contreras, where you are riding the roller coaster with the fans. Right? You are relishing the highs and you are being defeated by the lows, and the good, like, you are not staying even keeled. Abreu is the opposite. He is always here. He is always just balling out. I believe he had 4 homers over the weekend, 2 two-home-run games. He has 5 homers now over the stretch. He is one of those beautiful left-handed swings in the entire league. But I have really enjoyed watching him and Contreras as these same but different characters of this Red Sox hot streak.
Yeah, and Willier Abreu, for those unfamiliar, I mean, he has only played with the Red Sox in the majors, but he did not come up in their system, acquired in one heck of a trade from the Houston Astros. But I think, remember, he also had a couple big moments during the WBC. Him and Wilson Contreras, of course, countrymen from Venezuela. But as you mentioned, they really express it very differently. They're both very emotional, but it just is shown in a very different way. And you mentioned his steadiness as a persona and as a performer. It's also just this production. This is someone that you kind of know what you're getting. He has been exposed a little bit more to left-handers this season than he had been in the past. He's become more of an everyday player, but the overall production has been really steady. That said, Wilson Contreras, who hit his 22nd home run of the season over the weekend, to me, he's still the bigger story, not just because of everything that, of course, has gone on with his season and the personality and now embracing this Bowser nickname, which I can't get enough of. I love that so much. But he's having the best year of his career, and he is a difference maker in this lineup that they still are kind of lacking, right? Or that, like, they still need that because Roman Anthony hasn't played. Willier Abreu is very good. He hasn't been rattling off 2 homer games all season. He's just been a really steady guy. When you look at this last stretch and who's been performing well, it's not like Jarren Duran suddenly remembered how to be an 8-win player that he was 2 years ago. He's been awful. The whole time.
Awful.
He's remained. He was terrible before. He's actually been even worse than he was before this hot streak, which is as goofy as it is. Rafaela, interestingly, who was off to a terrific start, he's cooled off offensively. Certainly from a power standpoint, he's certainly taken a step back over the last few weeks. But Caleb Durbin, my goodness, look what he's been doing. Masataka Yoshida, God bless him. He has three hits and a homer in the first game of the doubleheader on Friday. He's hitting 368 during this stretch, even in these limited roles. He's rock solid. And then you're getting some more contributions from the bit players, like Monasterio's been hitting. Anthony Siegler, who's a very strange trajectory. He's suddenly contributing. And then I think most importantly is the fact that the pitching, even without Garrett Crochet, and most notably the bullpen, which was very good even when they were bad, has been excellent and a true superpower of this team. And we knew that even when they were bad, that it was going to be pitching and defense. That's what Craig Breslow was always talking about. We laughed at them for much of the season, even though some of that was coming true. That's because they couldn't hit. Now they're hitting enough for that pitching staff to actually make a difference and their effectiveness to earn victory after victory after victory.
It really is pitching and defense, even still, because when you go over the stretch of this 13-game win streak and you look at where they rank in WRC+, and what, like, they're a top five offense over that span. But to win 13 games in a row, you usually have to be like the best offense by a wide margin. You know, like, they've been very good. They have been a very good offense, but it is the pitching. The starting pitching has been great, and the bullpen has allowed 6 runs in 51 and two-thirds innings during the stretch. By comparison, that is the fewest in the sport. The most in the sport over that span is the A's, who have allowed 55 runs in 55 innings, is a different conversation for a different time. So where does this go from here, right? Like, this Red Sox team is alive with the sound of music. The season is back on. The game is not gone. They are the Tartan Army, you know, rejuvenated this operation from the dead. And the Red Sox are going to make a playoff push. What does that look like? So their two best players are still on the injured list. That is Roman Anthony, and that is Garrett Crochet. Go ahead. You make a face?
Well, I mean, at this point, expecting Roman Anthony to come anywhere close to what Wilson Contreras is producing, like, anytime soon, is probably unfair. So, yes, I know we've been saying that these are their two best players, and I think at this point, Wilson Contreras is their best hitter, and I don't expect that to change at any point this season. But yes, they are still missing those two very key points. And I think Crochet is a more interesting part about this, especially because they do have some other really good pitchers. Sonny Gray has been really good. And when we're thinking about their chances, we have to consider these other really good pitchers that they also have.
We roll our eyes all the time at the team that's in it that says, well, our deadline acquisition is going to be all these guys we're getting off the IL. And you're like, cop out. For the Red Sox, and honestly for the Yankees too, it's like as legitimate of a bad argument as I can remember. It's like, yeah, well, we're going to get Garrett Crochet and Roman Anthony back. Yeah, we're going to get Aaron Judge and, you know, Carlos Rodon and Max Fried and maybe Giancarlo Stanton back at some point. It's like, well, yeah, that actually does sound pretty good. What type of external additions, though, do the Red Sox need to make?
I mean, we know we'll be having plenty of trade deadline conversations. It's 2 weeks from today, so there's a lot of different directions we could go with that. But frankly, Roman Anthony, who, yes, had a 142 OPS plus last season in 71 games and looked like one of the best young hitters in the league, I sure hope that he can come back and be a really good hitter. I'm not saying he can. I'm not saying that. That said, with all due respect to Contreras and Abreu and Yoshida and some of these guys that are hitting better, this is still not a lineup that I am particularly impressed by. It's just not. I know they've certainly performed like it over the last 2 weeks, but I just have a hard time looking at this group, even with Anthony coming back, and thinking that this is an above average lineup. I really don't. I think it could be an average lineup, but I don't think it's a great lineup. So now,
Are we upgrading?
The pitching staff might be elite.
The pitching staff is incredible, and as we look for, like, that's built in. They maybe go get another bullpen arm. Crochet comes back. I love the arms that they have. The offense. Where are the holes in this lineup? So it's Duran in a corner outfield spot. in your mind, you're saying, well, we just have Anthony come back, right? It does not necessarily make sense for the Red Sox to acquire an outfielder. We joked and laughed that this team had too many outfielders at one point over the offseason. With Yoshida hitting as well as he is, he needs to stay in the DH spot. And so I'm not sure that's where you add. The place that makes sense to me, Jordan, Luis Arraez at second base is a great fit for this team.
Yeah, so second base, we mentioned Siegler. The other big name that has not come up is Trevor Story, who was terrible before he got injured, but is still a expensive veteran piece that presumably, if he does get healthy, is going to be someone they want to play. And then the other important one in this conversation is Marcelo Meyer, who has been, frankly, just disappointing. However you slice it, he's injured now also. He's someone that we were seeing at second base. IKF, one of their big offseason offensive additions, who they're paying a shocking amount of money to be essentially the last guy on the bench. He's also injured right now, but presumably has some place on this team. We mentioned that Monasterio and Romy. So I agree with you. By the way, they have Jamai Jones is on their team now. He homered in like his first appearance for the team, which
delightful.
That's like the kind of adding him to the, we need someone that can hit lefties now that Rob Ruffschneider is doing whatever it is that he's doing in Seattle. So I agree with you. I like that fit a lot. That would be definitely moving some of these part-time players out of the way because Arraez would be an everyday guy. That's not a bad thing. The real question is, right, how aggressive are they going to be at all? Are they going to be the team that bids the most for Luis Arraez when we assume he's going to be someone that is coveted by a lot of teams if there's not a lot of bats available? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, they just need dependability on offense from the infield spots that are not Wilson Contreras. Like, Durbin's been great. He's better than he started and worse than he's been. And then up the middle, like the Andrew Monasterio and, you know, Anthony Siegler production is wonderful. Is that going to sustain? I would say probably not. And so I think you do need to go out and get a more reliable piece. But that is a first world problem because what has happened here already is stunning. This team was dead. We had considered it a non-character. And then from the depths of nothing, here they are. And usually when a team does this and goes from first half afterthought to legitimate playoff contender, it is a gradual climb. Like the Tigers that year, it was like every week they'd win some games. And then you looked up and it was like, oh my God, the gritty Tigers are like, they're in the mix. The Red Sox are like, oh, 13, we're here. Remember how we were nothing? Now we're important again. The bad AL certainly helps them, but now they're a force to be reckoned with, and we just have to completely reconsider our opinions of this team. They have forced us in that position.
We've been focusing on second base. You know, shortstop has been, with Story out, we've got a little, Sungche Chang action, little Monasterio here and there. One big swing, if they really want to get bold, this would really require to like shove Trevor Story and Marcelo Meyer and pretend like they're not there, would be Zach Neto. Now, he's had a very weird season, but if the Angels are open for business with some of their guys under longer term contracts that are not just the pitchers, that is one that I could see being interesting. Neto has taken a step back this year, but the talent there, the upside with him, if you are kind of ready to make a really bold move, that one is one that I certainly like. All that said, everything you pointed out is correct. This is their longest win streak since 1948. I mean, that is an absurd thing. 13 is really, we've talked about this over the last couple of years because we've had a couple of these lengthy win streaks. Last year, both the Brewers and Twins had win streaks of this length. What is the number? Is it just double digits when we kind of perk up and we say, oh my God, this is, because to me, it is when you get to 10. The Cubs, remember, had two 10-game winning streaks. They ended at 10 this season. 13 does not happen very often. It's still alive. They got the Orioles coming to town this week. I don't know how much longer this is going to go, but what's the number? Is 13 the number where you say, oh my God, they've won 13 in a row?
Teen. When you start tacking on teen.
Okay.
Like the difference between 12 and 13 is bigger than the difference between 13 and 14 in my mind, you know?
Love that.
Because then you're clicking up teen, yep. teen. That for me is where it shifts. The Rays, L5, we should say, they lost. They got mopped. Longest of their season. Because the Yankees are also right now, it's not the end of the world for them. One last thing on this series that disappointed me. Wally, the Red Sox mascot, after the mop, walked onto the field with a broom.
And this is the second time. This is the second time. When they mopped the Yankees on Sunday Night Baseball, our pal Jason Benetti said on the broadcast, as they were going to commercial, when they cut to Wally, they said, we got to get Wally a mop. And they have not made the adjustment. So I am really disappointed in that. I will say, let me just quickly look how many more mop opportunities the Red Sox have this season. Of course, this was kind of it wasn't a bonus one because the rainout before was a 4-game series. So they just kind of moved it to later in the season. Let me see if they have another, especially at home. Do they have another mop opportunity? They don't. They have 4-game series remaining, but they are all on the road. So unless we're going to travel Wally to make a kind of, make a correction. No, I support that. I think that would be great. It's going to be tough for that to happen. So I agree. That was definitely disappointing. The Rays I still don't know how good they are, but what they do have to make sure of is to not get mopped in consecutive series, because they are now heading to Toronto for a 4-game series beginning tonight. All right, let's take a break. When we return, we will talk about those New York Yankees who did not look very good. They did not get swept, but they did not look very good this weekend against the Dodgers. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We had a 2024 World Series rematch and some big news. We need to talk about it. For the first time since Gerrit Cole forgot to cover first base, the Los Angeles Dodgers played some baseball at Yankee Stadium. 3-game set in the Bronx between the two-time defending champs and the Yankees, who were there too. Dodgers did take 2 out of 3 in this one. I was at the Friday game, and it was cool walking around talking to some of the Dodgers about their memories of the last time they'd been in that locker room. Evan Phillips said, yeah, it smells a little different than it did after winning Game 5 and dousing the room in champagne. Dalton Rushing was like, I was not there. He was like, I watched it from L.A., and so it is very cool to get to play at Yankee Stadium. The Dodgers went out in this rematch, which had a lot of hype, and they beat the Yanks 2 out of 3 times, winning Friday night. The comeback homer from Max Muncy off of Gerrit Cole. Aaron Boone opting to leave Gerrit Cole in that game. Cole was really good, which was encouraging. Yankees offense, not so much. Game 2, Yamamoto, complete game. His first regular season complete game, which is hilarious considering that he had back-to-back playoff complete games last year in October. And so on the broadcast, it was like Yamamoto's first complete game. And I was like, what? And it's like first regular season complete game. And the Dodgers won big in that one, knocking Cam Schlittler around. Game 3, though, Yanks edge the Dodgers 2-1. Jazz Chisholm go-ahead blast in the bottom of the 8th. And they avoid the sweep. But the big news out of this one is that Shohei Ohtani is now a one-way player.
Yes, at least for a little bit. He was still seen yesterday before Sunday Night Baseball in between games. He was thrown in the outfield, testing it out a little bit. Maybe you can help me out with a little bit of clarity here about the timing. Sure. Because going into the weekend, or even before I think they even got to New York, it was like, he's not pitching this weekend. I think they made that pretty clear. But then
let's give a little more context. Let's give a little more context than that. So Ohtani, not at the All-Star game, okay?
Right.
Pulls out of the All-Star game. And I think when that happened, we were cynical about it. The messaging from the Dodgers was Ohtani is going to get treatment on his knee. That was an injection of a lubricant, not a drainage. But when that happened, we were like, oh, no, his knee. he wants to take a nap and not go to All-Star, which is fair. However, we get to New York over the weekend, and he's supposed to pitch Wednesday against the Phillies in Philadelphia. That was the original plan. That was announced. Ohtani, Wednesday, Philly. That is then scrapped Sunday morning before the first game of the doubleheader, with Dave Roberts saying that Ohtani is effectively shut down from pitching for the foreseeable future. Quote, it's not going to be a day-to-day thing. The first step is getting him into a spot where he feels like, and we feel like, he can pitch and not regress. At that point in time, we can kind of read and react. I just can't even when that might be right now. So there is no timeline here. Shohei Ohtani is not going to win the Cy Young. He is not going to pitch for at least a month, would be my guess. And it throws, what's that?
I just like, I don't think we know. I mean, that is what it sounds like. But I don't think Dave has any idea when he's going to pitch again. I guess this is also one of those things where the buildup, what does that mean? How long it's been since he amassed any sort of workload? Maybe that factors in. So I'm not going to put any time on it when he's not going to. But yeah, I'm not expecting to see him, but who knows?
If someone says it's not a day-to-day thing, in my mind, it's at least 2 weeks, because it's like, for pitchers, that's one, they're going in on a six man. So it's like, that's one, a start is a week, right? So I think this, if he's going to say this is going to take some time, it's going to take some time. Dave Roberts is usually kind of upfront about that type of thing. I think that like there's a lot of different threads here with Ohtani. I'd like to focus on like him first, and then we'll talk about what it means for the Dodgers after. There's been this push-pull in Ohtani's career about what he wants to do and what is best for the team. And often those two things are compatible, because Shohei Ohtani going out there and hitting a bunch of home runs and striking out a bunch of guys is good for the team. What is best for the 2026 Dodgers, obviously, is for Ohtani to not pitch and to rest his knee and to rest himself and to take it easy and to not chase these individual accomplishments and to go out in October and set the world on fire again as they try and go for the three-peat. But sometimes Ohtani has these personal goals, which are understandable. He has been up front. He wants to win the Cy Young this year. And I thought that this was an interesting moment of him kind of grappling, handling, being aware and accepting his own limitations, right? Could Shohei Ohtani have pitched through this ailment that he's facing? My guess would be yes. If there was a playoff game tomorrow, I think they would just pump his knee with the good stuff and he would go out there and throw five, right? But what we have here is Ohtani seeing the bigger picture, or the Dodgers communicating that bigger picture to Ohtani. And I think that is really important, because the Cy Young as the last mountain for him to climb, that must mean something significant to Ohtani. We don't know, because he never talks and we know so little about this guy, but I think it's fair to deduce that him giving up on this thing is not easy for him. And so I do think in this moment, he deserves a little bit of kudos for getting the bigger picture at play.
Yeah. And it's also just much more simply another example of him pushing the physical limits. He's proven that from a talent standpoint, there's nothing we can say anymore. He is one of the best pitchers in the world. He is one of the best hitters in the world. That is amazing. At his best, he is the best at both, and it is completely nonsense that we are living in this time and get to watch this. So in terms of can he do it, the answer at this point is obviously yes. Can his body hold up to do it to the maximum degree that he would like to? I think the answer to this point is no. I mean, which is fine, because it might not matter as long as he can do it in October when it counts the most. And I'm sure at this point, he's also recognizing that my goal is to win 10 World Series in my 10 years with the Dodgers. And he's 2 for 2. And he clearly knows that once he gets to October, if he can get back to do the best version of that, that has to be the goal. I'm sure at some point when he was dealing with this over the last month or so, he thought, no, there's still time for me to pitch enough innings to win the Cy Young. To your point, it probably feels like once that started to slip away, he could kind of let go and be like, all right, fine. I will focus on being the best leadoff hitter that I can be, which he continues to be quite good at. And I will get my body right. But I think that it is just a small thing. We don't know exactly how he's feeling, how much pain he's in. He continues to hit and run the bases and do all these things. But it is an example of the fact that his body can only handle so much. And that's fine. That's a completely understandable series of events for this to happen, considering he's only getting older. He's been through a lot already. He's had his multiple arm surgeries. And it's not surprising that it's finally some other part of his body is like, ow, I'm doing too much baseball. That is not a shocking development at all.
People are always like, oh, listen to your body. I think we're listening to Otani's body. It is worth understanding his left knee and how it functions in pitching and in hitting. So one of the most interesting things to me about Otani and what makes him one of the 90 million things that makes him remarkable is that as a right-handed thrower and a left-handed swinger, he is rotating in two different directions. So like his body symmetry is outrageous, right? I can never really comprehend. His left knee when he's pitching is his lead leg. And there is a lot of force. Kind of every time you pitch, you are slamming that lead leg into the ground and then catapulting your body over that lead leg and putting all the weight on that leg. When you're hitting, because he's a left-handed hitter, that's his plant leg. You are not slamming it into the ground. Now, you need to be able to push off of it, and there's still a lot of ground forces involved, but there's no impact on that leg into the ground over and over and over again. And it seems that that is where the discomfort's coming from. There was a moment in yesterday's game, I think in game one of the doubleheader, he fouled a ball off of the knee, off of his left knee. And you could kind of see him rubbing it and shaking it out past what you would expect given the play itself. Like, it was clear that it wasn't at 100%. The fact that he's still able to go out there and be one of the best leadoff hitters on the planet is remarkable. What a player. I'm curious to see if it impacts his sprint speed, his ability to run. That is something worth keeping an eye on. But do I think this will make him a worse hitter? No, I do not. He has clocked long balls through Tommy John rehab before. I will never doubt this man. Let's talk about the Cy Young. That's dead. I think we agree with that. NL MVP, is it up for grabs now? Because Pete Crow Armstrong, who I think would be the number two guy in a lot of people's ballots right now, during All-Star was asked about this. He's like, what do you think you need to do to beat Otani for MVP? He's like, I need to do a throwing program in the offseason and learn how to pitch. That's the only way I'm beating this guy. Now, if Otani throws, let's just say throws four more starts, does he still win this unanimously?
Let's just say he doesn't pitch again in the regular season. All right, for the sake of argument.
Great.
Because I still don't think this is a conversation, but let's indulge. All right. Let's try to think it out. Let's say he doesn't pitch again in the regular season, but he finishes his OPS is still higher than PCA. Yes, PCA is playing one of the best center fields we've ever seen, and Otani is a DH, so that you could say that cancels out, right? And we'll see how PCA, God bless him, that is someone that we've seen is also liable to go ridiculously ice cold over a long stretch. So I have no idea how he's going to finish his season, which is another thing. Let's just not just extrapolate on how he's going to go. That said, I mean, I'm sorry, people. I know it's boring, but if Otani doesn't pitch again, he's banked 14 of the best starts that any pitcher has made this season, on top of the fact that he is going to have 30 homers and probably an OPS over 900. Like, I know people are talking. Sorry, he's still the right answer. I don't really know what else to say. I feel bad for all the people in the National League. But yeah, please. I mean, you're welcome to. I don't think it's. I would not be hard for me to vote for Otani without thinking about it. I say maybe it opens the door for other people to get a vote or two. I do not, which is still significant because he's won so many of these unanimously. So that would still be news. Like, that would still be a big deal for anybody to even wrestle away a vote or two from him. But as far as him not winning, no, it just, I do not think this opens the door whatsoever, even if he does not pitch again this season.
I think it opens the door, and it only opens the door for PCA. If PCA fit, do I think this will happen? No, I think Ohtani will win unanimously. If PCA's offensive numbers are at or above Ohtani, there is a PCA argument. That argument is that his defense is as valuable as Ohtani's pitching, right? Because he is a singular defender. No one in the sport is as good at defense as Pecor Armstrong is, right?
Yep.
And so then if you're saying that and Ohtani on the mound is even, and then you have PCA's offensive line and Ohtani's offensive line, that's even. In my mind, then the tiebreaker would be PCA having 25 steals and Ohtani having 6 right now. You know, like, I think there's a path there. I do. Like, sure. PCA at this point in time, like, could he go 40-40? Probably not. He's at 21 homers, 25 steals. He'll go 30-30 for sure. Like, again, I'll take Ohtani. Probably. Yeah. I'll take Ohtani 97 times out of 100. But I think last week I would have taken him 100 out of 100. And that is notable to me.
Yeah, I think it is fair. It is interesting. I think, and by the way, let's just play it really straight. Fangraphs, hilariously, I don't think this even existed before Ohtani, but now it does. They're combined WAR leaderboards. I guess they have it because then you can compare the hitters and pitchers on the same page. But because it lists his both batting WAR and pitching WAR, Ohtani right now is at 6.1. PCA is at 5.9. Then it's a huge drop off to Bobby Witt, Yordan, Miz, you know, Otto Lopez, God bless him. So you're right. And PCA, while I am not as impressed by PCA being the best center fielder than Ohtani being one of the best pitchers, obviously, he is out there a whole lot more than Ohtani is, right? I believe he spent more innings in the field than almost any defender in the league, besides maybe Matt Olson and Ozzie Albies. I know it's pretty close. So yeah, I think you can sort of argue that while he cannot singularly change impact a single game in the same way that Ohtani can when he takes the mound and throws 6 awesome innings, I think it is an interesting argument. I think what it will depend on, though, is what I alluded to earlier, which is that PCA has proven to be very streaky. And so let's see where that OPS ends up. Let's see where that OBP ends up. Right now, it's obviously an enormous step forward from even what he did last year offensively, which is why he's in these conversations. That's why his WAR is so high, in addition to his amazing defense. So I agree. This is interesting. For now, I'm going to defer to the greatest baseball player we've ever seen, who threw 14 amazing starts.
Fair.
And has a 900 OPS.
Fair. Fair.
No arguments, which, by the way, it sounds like PCA agrees. So at least for now. So
that is true.
So let's give him that.
For the Dodgers moving forward, they're going to stick with the 6-man. That means they are going to either bullpen game their way through that 6th spot. They'll call up some guys. Like, Snell is starting to work his way back again. Where is Tyler Glass now? Gavin Stone, River Ryan. Like, they have injured pitchers that will at some point return as well. Do they need to add someone at the deadline? They have like Cole Irvin in AAA. It would be silly to see them go get an arm, but if they're going to stick with the 6-man, I do think it is going to be interesting to see how they cover that spot every time through the rotation.
I was going to say that they have to press the River Ryan button here at some point, but it seems like he's maybe hurt again also.
Yeah, he's hurt. He's
not pitched. He is hurt. Since June 17th. That is disappointing because of how he looked early on in the season. But yeah, how they patch it together on the mound through the rest of the regular season will be interesting. But also, frankly, it's hard to really care that much because they are...
They're treating this like spring training.
Yeah, 11 and a half games up. Which is honestly a good transition to our next topic, because while the Dodgers did not sweep over the weekend, we did have a couple of sweeps, including perhaps the Dodgers' top competition for the top seed of the National League, the Milwaukee Brewers. Let's do it. How sweep it is.
Clean up, everybody. There is no shame in getting swept.
I never got swept.
You guys got swept.
The Milwaukee Brewers took all three over the Miami Marlins over the weekend. They got a Garrett Mitchell walk-off on Friday, a William Contreras monumental walk-off home run with a bat flip to match on Sunday. They got a solid Shane Drouin start on Saturday. That guy's pretty good, and honestly, maybe important because Kyle Harrison is no longer pitching, at least not right now. This was, I mean, the Marlins were playing like one of the best teams in baseball for all of June and into July. So to welcome the fish into town and swat them away, this was an impressive showing for Milwaukee. They also got some bad news over the weekend with Brandon Woodruff announcing that he needs shoulder surgery again, which is frankly just depressing because of what this guy has been already been through from an injury standpoint. It's just been a kind of a strange couple years with Brandon Woodruff and how they've managed his contract and with the QO and the extension. And clearly there's a lot of loyalty here. This is one of the most important people and figures in the franchise. And he has essentially always been good when he's pitched, but he's been so injury prone lately that it's hard to be shocked when this happens. So Brandon Woodruff's not going to be a factor, which is disappointing for him because of how hard he's tried to be a part of this latest era of Brewers baseball, which frankly is one of the most successful ever. This is the fastest they've ever been to 60 wins in franchise history, which says a lot considering how good they were last season. But I guess they really hit it up last year, more down the last couple months. But this is really impressive. And while this series, their division lead is not as big, it's 6 games over the Cubs compared to 11 and a half games over the Diamondbacks or the Dodgers. What I'm thinking about with the Brewers, especially now with Miz and how they're going to manage his innings, I know he's scheduled to pitch tonight. How badly do they want the top seed? How badly do they want, like, how are they going to treat the regular season? Now, the Cubs can get hot and maybe make them sweat it and force them to really push it and make sure that Miz makes every start instead of telling him to take it easy. But the Brewers are in an interesting spot here where they've proven that they are just a wins machine in the regular season. How do they manage it the rest of the way? Do they try to get that top seed or do they try and make sure that, like the Dodgers, they just have their best players available for October, whether that is Miz, whether that is Kyle Harrison, whether that is Christian Yelich, frankly, and just some of their other key players. So what are you thinking about the Brewers after their sweep this weekend?
I don't think the top seed matters that much for this team. They just want to get one of the two byes. They had the number one overall seed and home field advantage last year against the Dodgers in the NLCS. How'd that go?
Yeah.
Like, if that's a goal, maybe it should be.
As bad as it could be.
I just don't think they will sacrifice preparation for the top seed. Nor should they. I think they'll act more Dodgers-y the bigger the gap between them and the Cubs gets. The Dodgers this year just have the benefit of San Diego being bad and the Diamondbacks being stuck. Like, the NL West is bad and way worse than what the NL Central is, and I think that is the important difference in the dynamic. The one other thing from this series we really should just bring up, this William Contreras bat flip was ridiculous. Bat flip discourse, bat flip chat, as it's wonderfully become more acceptable and embedded in the game, bat flips don't stand out from one another in the way that they used to. We have seen like 10 bat flips more ostentatious than Joey Bats' bat flip, right? Like, we have passed that point now. But because they're everywhere, every day feels like Christmas. Nothing stands out. This one, the sheer height on it, I think this might be the highest bat flip I have ever seen.
We've seen versions of this. We've seen, including like from William Contreras for sure. you know, Junior Caminero's had some lofty ones for sure. But yes, the way that he threw it, right, the kind of gather and then launch with two hands is really something to behold. Did you see the other weird moment with him over the weekend where he chucked the ball into the stands after the final out?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I found that to be even more notable than the bat flip. It's, you know, very common. Well, more common when you have a strikeout, you maybe throw it down to third, even if it's the end of the inning. William Contreras caught a for the strikeout to end an inning. He turned around and threw it like, I don't know how far it went. I know that now when guys throw balls into the stands, it needs to clear the net, so the angle is always a lot higher than it, you know, maybe used to be. But if you haven't seen this clip, this is very funny, very straight. He just turned around and threw it what looked to be like in the upper deck. I don't know how far it reached, but hopefully people were paying attention there, because that was very, very odd.
I don't want to rekindle memories of this, but the closest comparison was Trevor Bauer getting pulled from a game and chucking the ball over the center field fence.
Yeah, you're right. That's true. It was very strange. It was very funny. I guess I missed the background on that. I don't know if he was asked about that, but anyway, Brewers are good. Marlins are also maybe good, but this was like Brewers being like, all right, okay, Marlins, you're having a nice season.
We're the settle best down.
Like, welcome to the big leagues of the National League. Yeah, this is basically what that said. All right, let's talk about the other sweep from the weekend. Oh my goodness, am I reading this correct? The Baltimore Orioles have won 7 games in a row. They go into Houston, and take all 3.
Yeah,
from the just what are the Houston Astros? Who knows? They have a couple really close, impressive wins. On Friday and Saturday, they come back with Taylor Ward go-ahead homer late on Friday, and then they win in extras on Saturday. Then Sunday was just a regular old W, but it is not a regular old W, because 7 games in a row is by far the longest winning streak for the Baltimore Orioles this season. They are still how many games under 500? They're okay, two games under 500. They are still in fourth place. But hey, they're only 2 games behind those red hot Red Sox, and I think 2 games out of the third wildcard spot. I was ready to bury them. I know that their record never got that bad, but just because of how inconsistent they were, just the vibes around the Orioles, I was ready to think about them, especially with the trade deadline coming up, because they have a lot that they could move. I was ready to just switch them into that mode. And now I don't know really what to make of them, but at the very least, they look... This was a nice statement over another team trying to stay in the mix in the AL postseason race. So you got to give them credit for that.
Doing it on the road is really impressive. They play the Red Sox this week. Oh, that is spicy. That is the good stuff. That is what, a W7 against a W13 in Fenway? Yes, please. And they've done this with Gunnar Henderson still being bad. He is a fascinating character in this Orioles season. He has not been, like, full season-wise, like, unplayable, but he is well below what we thought this guy was going to be. Remember, at the WBC, this was the thing that was going to happen. Like, it was the Gunnar Henderson moment.
Yes.
He was getting benched for Bregman, and everyone was mad, and then he would get to play, and he would go yard. There was the clip of him running into second for a double, and everyone was like, this is the best athlete I've ever seen. He goes deep and hits a solo shot in the semis against the Dominican, and it's off Severino throwing 100. Like, we were ready for the Gunnar Henderson full blast, and we just haven't gotten it. I think a lot of it is mental. He is chasing way more. He's trying to do too much. When he expands his zone, he's not hitting the ball at optimal angles enough anymore. It's just a very odd season from a very talented player who at 25 should be entering his prime.
Yeah, it feels like the Adley Rutschman rejuvenation came at the cost of Gunnar Henderson. Frankly, just not. I mean, last season was a disappointment for Gunnar Henderson because of how good he was at 24. and he was still a 5-win player. So it was hard to, and he was the only one that was healthy. He was like the only one that was at least sort of doing a good job amid a disaster Orioles season. And now he's taken another huge step back to where you can't even really defend it. You can't even say, well, yeah, he's not what he was in 24, but he's still a really good player. That was last year. This year, there's really no way to spin it. Sure, he's still got 17 home runs, but I mean, I don't think that he's suddenly bad now, but you really can't spin this season other than it has been a massive disappointment. One of the biggest disappointments and steps back in the league, not quite on like Cal Raleigh level, but there are some pretty huge fall offs across the league from the standards that we've been used to some of these players. And this is right up there. This is right up there among guys who we thought were just going to be perennial MVP candidates. And I don't see him getting any votes this year unless he really goes nuts in the last couple months and the Orioles make the playoffs.
The glass half full perspective is, with the team getting on a roll, does it take some pressure off? Can he get hot as this team moves towards the deadline? The other Orioles thing just to bring up is Kyle Bradish contract extension. 5 years, $90 million, buys out 3 free agent years. The second extension the Orioles have given to one of their starting pitchers this season, joining Shane Baz. Bradish, with a very interesting trajectory, came over from the Angels in one of those rebuild trades, finishes fourth in Cy Young in 2023, I believe, misses a lot of 24 and 25 coming back from Tommy John surgery, and struggled a little bit at the start of the year, but has kind of picked things up as he's gotten further and further away from that surgery. He has a 2.95 ERA since May 8th. If you are the Orioles and you are saying to yourself, we need to find a legitimate needle moving rotation piece, this is a pretty good way to do it. And if you project ahead, I think this is a great deal for the O's. Like, $90 million for a guy that could be a down ballot Cy Young candidate in the next couple of seasons is a good bit of business.
And also for a guy, right, coming off surgery, and this seems to strike the balance perfectly of, yeah, any pitcher at this stage of his career, what he's already been through, to just secure $90 million instead of chasing the last dollar in the next few years. I think this makes a lot of sense. And I have to imagine this sets a nice line for other, because we don't get that many pitcher extensions. They're usually a little strange because of just all the different factors you have to consider. This is one that I imagine a lot of teams around the league are going to look at and be like, okay, this is where we're kind of aiming for with a mid-rotation guy that we believe in that is maybe approaching free agency, but is not quite there. All right, one more series before we take a break. Let's stay in the American League East. Toronto Blue Jays. This is not what this was supposed to look like. I think the thing that really shocks me, and I've written this a few times, and I just keep like saying it out loud because it's just so hard. How many teams had a better offseason? I mean, Dylan Cease is terrific. He started the All-Star game. Okamoto has 22, 23 home runs. He's the only one on their team with more than 9 home runs, unless that changed over the weekend. They only have one double-digit homer guy, and it's Okamoto with 22. Okay, you can fact-check that for me. Tyler Rogers, he's got like a 1.6 ERA. I know Cody Ponce blew out, and that was someone. But those are your big three additions, and you're terrible. And it's not like Bo Bichette is tearing. I know he's been better recently, but I am just kind of in shock. I know injuries have played a huge part in this, but even factoring that in, knowing that Barger has been out a lot and they missed Kirk, and I can't believe how bad it's been. Their offense is so bad right now. Vlad is still trying to find it, still looking for that first home homer. Nearly had it on Saturday in their 1-0 victory, but they got dominated in the other two games. I mean, the White Sox just looked like clearly the better team on Friday and Sunday, and that is a credit to Chicago, who clearly is a team we need to take seriously. But I am certainly running out of optimism for the Blue Jays. And I hate to say that because of the vibes that they gave us in October. And for all of last regular season, this was not just a magical run in October.
Yeah.
They were the top seed. They earned it. They were steady all year last year. I know it's a very different roster, but man, oh man, the Blue Jays. Yikes.
There is a very wonky irony to their offseason being awesome and the team being bad, when in 2025 they were coming off of what was an awful offseason to go to the World Series. Jimenez, not that good. Jeff Hoffman, kind of disappointing. Anthony Santander, utter disaster. Max Scherzer, started game set. Like, they did not crush the offseason heading into 25, and it didn't matter. And then they crushed this offseason, and it also doesn't matter. What a weird team. Hopefully they can turn it around. The whiplash for John Schneider and the entire Blue Jays coaching staff coming back from the All-Star game, which in a way is like the last celebration of the thing that you accomplished.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you made the World Series, you didn't win, but you made it. You were a part of the story. Here's your honor. Go to the All-Star game. And then, you know, winning the All-Star game by bullpen gaming your way through it, returning home to your bad team and being like, oh, I want to go back to Philadelphia. Let's take a break, Jordan. Let's take a break. When we get back, we'll go fast. We promise, we swear.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Before we throw it into turbo mode, a quick field report. I attended the series finale between the Pirates and Guardians. I contemplated going on Friday, and then Cleveland was engulfed in smoke, and they postponed the game. I thankfully did not leave my house on Friday or Saturday. We'll probably be dealing with some more wildfire smoke this week. But Sunday, after some rain on Saturday night, was an absolutely beautiful day for Paul Skenes against Joey Cantillo. I was in the building for that. Anytime Skenes is in town throwing the baseball, I'm like, yeah, I'll go check that out. If you didn't watch this game, you would say, oh, nice. Paul Skenes went 7 innings for the first time since May 12th. He must have been dominant. And I think Paul Skenes will be the first one to tell you he wasn't that good. The Guardians ran into 5 outs on the bases. They had 9 base runners yesterday, and 5 of them were erased on the bases, which is just one of the worst, sloppiest games we've seen from Cleveland all season, which was disappointing because they got a Travis Bazzano walk-off home run on Saturday night in the second game of that doubleheader. Paul Skenes, though, going 7 was still good. The Pirates offense showed up, and it was still a good day for Pittsburgh. But in addition to Skenes, who's still having a very strange season, throwing a ton of four-seam fastballs, he's pitching to contact, trusting his defense, which for the most part has not worked out, but it certainly worked out yesterday. I'm not that worried about Skenes. I still think that I'm not saying going through the motions, because that would obviously be disrespectful to the amount of work and focus that he puts in to getting through the season. But now they've won, I think, 3 of his starts in a row, 4 starts in a row since that ridiculous 9-game losing streak with him on the mound. And I think he's gonna do just fine. I think he's gonna pitch his way into the top 5 at Cy Young, and I'm not worried about Paul Skenes. But the one Pirates thing we do want to talk about, because I know he got your attention when you saw the Pirates in Pittsburgh, is Esmerlin Valdez. And this is a character that you maybe have started to hear about because he is on one heck of a heater to begin his career. He hits his 12th home run on Sunday, his 11th home run on Saturday in the first game of the doubleheader, but I was there for his 12th homer. He now has 12 home runs in his first 31 games. He's hitting .305, .373, .733, slugging .733. Does the guy have a 37% strikeout rate? He most certainly does, but he's also walking 10% of the time. And his profile is very interesting.
So
because
great.
He doesn't, and it's funny because you hear all of his teammates and Don Kelly say, like, this guy's at-bats are really good. Like, he has a professional approach. We could tell that in spring training. He was unbelievable in the fall league last year. And then you say, okay, well, why does he have a 37% strikeout rate? Because he swings the bat so hard, and he does have holes in his swing, but he does know what he's doing. Like, it is a very intentional approach.
He doesn't chase.
I don't
at all.
Yeah, he doesn't chase. He's just swinging and missing in the zone, which is going to happen when you swing the bat this fast and you don't have that great barrel control. But the right-handed juice right now is as good as we have. And a Pirates lineup that was already really impressive now has this other really dangerous threat in the middle. And it just kind of raises the bar of what I think is possible for this Pirates team, as kind of weird of a season as it's been. So I'm super impressed with Esmerlin. He's got the nickname The Magician because, you know, Merlin the Magician. I don't know how much Esmerlin knew about Merlin the Magician as a child growing up in the Dominican Republic, but maybe a lot. Maybe this is something he's always dreamed of being called.
very charismatic guy. I watched some interviews with him. He is one of those players who's just like loving the fact that he is a Major League Baseball player, which we always appreciate. If you go to his Baseball Savant, you can do like similarity scores where it's how similar is this guy's offensive profile to other hitters? Like who is the most, you know, I think it's called like affinity. The top three guys are Aaron Judge, Ellie De La Cruz, and James Wood, right? He is hitting the crap out of the baseball. He is whiffing a ton in the zone, and he is walking more than you'd expect because he doesn't expand. Mm-hmm. He is kind of fundamentally changing the way I'm thinking about the Pirates offense. Because even though they added like these pieces, the absence of O'Neill Cruz over the last 2 months, like, has been felt a little bit.
Missing Horwitz is a big deal. And like, now Connor Griffin out. Like, they need another, they need at least one other guy to step up, and Valdez is doing it.
His home runs are beautiful. Like, one of the concerns with him as a prospect was that he wasn't going to get to heat at the top of the zone. He's had some where there was one he hit off Pierce Johnson. I think it was like 461. It's the furthest homer in PNC Park by a rookie ever. Like, he has some unreal. Go watch some Esmerlin Valdez highlights. Like, this guy is outstanding to watch.
Last thing on Valdez that I want to mention before we wrap up the weekend. What's so amazing about it is that he starts the year in AAA. He has his heater in May. He gets called up, homers twice in five games, but then gets sent back down. This is not someone that was like, okay, he's up for good. Now he's here. He went back down to Indy for a few more weeks, hit a few more home runs in AAA. Gets called back up on June 11th, and then he homers in four straight games at the end of June, kind of goes cold for a little bit, and then now he's got six homers in his last seven games and is just batting cleanup for the Pirates, and he's playing right field. And we'll see how this lineup kind of shakes out and what it looks like once they get Horwitz back and O'Neill Cruz, who doesn't seem to be that close to coming back, and of course Connor Griffin, hopefully in September. But yeah, it's just a huge part now, especially with Horwitz out, because he's been so steady for them. Having a right-handed hitter like this is, you're so right, though. Just from an aesthetic standpoint, he's also just a lot of fun to watch swing the bat. All right, we got nine more series. It's time to go fast. Let's do turbo mode.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
Let's start with Tigers taking 2 out of 3 over the Angels. They almost get the sweep, but Casey Mize only goes 3 1/3 inning after getting hit in the wrist with a comebacker. After that game, AJ Hinch was like, he also has recurring groin issues. We're going to have to go get that checked out. Tigers need Casey Mize. That was a bummer. They almost pulled off the sweep. We had Skubal, 7 scoreless on Saturday. The Will Skubal get traded meter is still pointing towards no for me.
I agree. However, like Tigers, you got to sweep the Angels, right? We can't be messing around anymore. This, you should have been a conversation earlier when we were talking about the Reds. I was like, and the Tigers are back in it. Got to sweep the Angels. But, you know, good to see Skubal. Troy Melton, he is awesome. Let's go to the desert where the Arizona Diamondbacks took 2 out of 3 over the St. Louis Cardinals, including a ridiculous comeback down 7-0 on Sunday. This is more the snakes I'm used to. This offense has not actually been good this season. It's been very weird to watch, but they rally back. They win this game. They win this series. Max Kepler, who's on the Diamondbacks. Yes, Max Kepler. He walks it off with an RBI double. And this was a nice comeback after not a good loss on Friday for the Snakes.
We had a highlight reel ABS moment on Friday. I was watching this game live. Ketel Marte in the 9th, down 1. He's up. I believe go-ahead runs on 2nd. Pitch above the zone on a 2-2 count. Strike 3. Arizona has 2 challenges and he just walks off the field. Like, this was 3 balls above the zone. The thing is, if you are the last out of the game on a called strike 3 call and you have challenges left, it should be an automatic tap, right? Whether or not it's a strike. If it's down the middle, whatever, use it. Like, it doesn't matter. You can't take him home with you. And Cattell not using this here, I think, was the biggest why didn't you challenge that pitch we've had so far this season.
Yeah, I mean, stakes-wise, I can't remember a worse situation than that. And if the Diamondbacks, that's a little dramatic. But, you know, Diamondbacks missed the playoffs by one game, which has happened in recent memory. This is not something that will be completely forgotten in that situation. The Braves take 2 out of 3 over the Texas Rangers. Remember, Atlanta had been playing some really bad baseball going into the break. One of the worst teams in baseball since the start of June, but they had that gigantic lead. This looked more like it. They completely destroy Texas on Friday, 15-1. Lose a close one on Saturday, but they bounce back on Sunday, 8-5. And the biggest takeaway here is that Drake Baldwin looks like Drake Baldwin again. He had been really struggling since coming off the IL about a month ago, and he basically just made up 10 for 14 with, what, 3 homers over the weekend?
3 homers.
Really, really impressive from Drake Baldwin to get his line back to now where we're just back to like, oh yeah, he's like a top 10 MVP finisher, like pretty clearly. That is what he was trending towards before he got injured. I know he missed a good amount of time, but he is one of the best catchers in baseball, and it was nice to see him perform like it again over the weekend.
When you're a catcher and you're coming off the IL, your body is handling so much more than anyone else. We've seen this with Cal Raleigh too. It can take some time. And to see Drake Baldwin flip back into God mode means that he is physically capable of his best now.
Yeah.
And so I would that was an open question before the All-Star break. It was like, is Drake Baldwin still hurt? If he is, that's a big deal for the Braves. Him going out and like emphatically saying, oh, here's 10 for 14 with 3 homers. Everyone take a seat.
Speaking of Cal Raleigh, he goes 0 for 10 over the weekend to drop his season line to 163, 267, 298.
Oof.
Mariners win the series.
2 out of 3, okay.
Mariners win the series. Oh, boy. We'll have to have a Cal Raleigh conversation at some point here. I do it on Seattle Radio every week. So if you really want my take on Cal, go check me out on Bump and Stacey on Wednesdays because they're asking me every week. And I certainly have had my thoughts fluctuate. But for the purposes of this podcast, we will focus on the Mariners taking 2 out of 3, which was a nice comeback after looking completely just terrible, embarrassing showing on Friday. And for most of Saturday as well, until Cole Young hits a game-tying 3-run homer late in that one off Logan Webb. And going through that first in a game and the first part of the second game, it was like, oh my God, are they going to sweep? They're still the only team that hasn't swept any team this season. The Mariners look hopeless. Oh, there we go. Here come Tony V and the No. Mariners walk it off on Saturday and then win on Sunday with some more late home runs. So nice to see the Mariners like beat a bad baseball team, but still a lot to prove for Seattle. Speaking of good baseball teams beating bad baseball teams, how you like that transition? The Washington Nationals, another team who is 50-50. I believe the two 50-50 teams are the Nationals and the Seattle Mariners. How about that? The Nationals win 23-4 on Friday. The thing is that like, yeah, this would be a series where you would expect one team to win 23-4 and then the other team to win 15-1, which according to Sarah Langs was like historic by some measure in terms of the swing and run differential from one game to the next. But this is exactly the series where you would think that could happen. Thankfully for the Nationals, they do win on Sunday because Foster Griffin is a freaking beast. But those first two games were pretty hilarious.
I ran into Nationals pitching coach Simon Matthews at dinner at a restaurant in DC on Wednesday night. And as I was like, hey, man, I met his wife. He met my wife, who's, you know, serendipitous. And I was like, where are you headed? Where are you guys start the second half? He goes, Sacramento. And in my mind, I was like, I think I might have said to him, this could be a lot of runs. And he was like, yeah. And that is exactly what we saw. Go ahead.
And you know where they are this week?
Colorado.
Yeah. So Simon Matthews buckle up, do your best. At least Simon Matthews can take a breather whenever Foster Griffin takes the mound. Oh,
he's so, good. He's so good.
He's so good. He's so good. You know who's not so good? The San Diego Padres, who avoided getting swept by the lowly Kansas City Royals with an angry victory. We haven't talked a lot about angry wins this year. This is usually something we talk about in college baseball when there's just a massive upset where some bad program, you know, squeaks out a win against
Manhattan,
a ranked team.
Takes and the Friday game from Florida State. You know?
And then we get what we call an angry win, where it's like, oh my God, that was so embarrassing. We need to really take out our frustration on them. That is what happened with the Padres winning 19-2 on Sunday. That does not take away from the fact that they lost two really, really bad losses for San Diego on Friday and Saturday, which they frankly cannot afford at this point if they want to stay remotely relevant in this National League postseason race. They have already plummeted down the standings after a strong first 2 months, but just an awful loss on Friday where Mason Miller, Houdini act, bases loaded, nobody outs, he gets out of it, and then they still lose in extras. They get crushed on Saturday, and then, you know, good you don't get swept because the Royals are really bad, but Padres are really, really losing any sort of confidence. Which, by the way, coming into the season, I was like, this could go very wrong, and we're sort of sorry to see that. Do I expect AJ Preller to not still try and acquire a bunch of players? No, he's going to do that. I mean, he's going to buy. We know that's going to happen, but I'm not really sure what that's going to do for the San Diego Padres.
Mariners fans, do you miss watching Cal Raleigh? Okay, well, just watch the Rockies because they have Cal Raleigh at home. That is Hunter Goodman. He has now 5 multi-homer games this season, the most in Major League Baseball. He had a 3-home run game on Sunday, his 2nd 3-home run game this season. That means he is now within reach of becoming just the 2nd player in MLB history with 3 3-home run games in a season, a record held by Sammy Sosa. That would be very cool if Hunter Goodman were to make that type of history. He is one of the best catchers in the world, in the sport. Does he deserve more love? Yes. Hunter Goodman taking like a half step up is one of the more encouraging Rockies developments this year because he is clearly taking some of this new information that the Rockies are implementing into their world and putting it to good use. Now, I should say the Reds won that game. Hunter Goodman hit 3 home runs and the Rockies lost, which is really all you need to know. Neither of these teams are worth spending any more time on right now. Mets take 2 out of 3 over the Phillies in Philadelphia. Whoa. That Thursday game that they had to play through the smoke for no reason. Mets took that one. Schwarber hits his 33rd on Saturday. Sean Manaea is not very good. Phillies win. And then game 3, like the Philadelphia Phillies right now just straight up don't have a viable 5 starter. It is the biggest need they have at the deadline and arguably like the biggest need of any contender. They don't need a pitcher that can pitch in October. They very much don't need that. Their top 2, their top 3 is incredible. Aaron Nola, for all of his flaws, is fine. They're starting Alan Ronhell every 5 days, and it's just like it's like a pre-loss. That's a spot that was an automatic loss with Taijuan Walker, and then it was an automatic loss with Andrew Painter, and now is it an automatic loss with Alan Ronhell? I think they just need like Michael Lorenzen or like a boring 5 innings, 3 runs. You could win the baseball game because it certainly doesn't feel like
obviously this hypothetical pitcher is not going to start a game in the postseason, but for them to get to the postseason in good position or chase down the Braves, you can't just be punting games every 5 days. And that's pretty much where we're at. So I think it's a little bit of a stretch to say that this is like the biggest problem the Phillies have, but it's been pretty bad.
I mean,
every
5 days they just have an automatic loss. Like, adding, I'm just searching for an arm here. Does adding a Patrick Sandoval or a Mike Soroka fundamentally change your playoff capabilities. Maybe, maybe not. But it makes you more viable right now. That's for freaking sure. Zach Littell. Even like Zach Littell, who is not that good. They just need an adult to start every 5 days. Cubs, 2 out of 3 over the Twins. We could do an hour on Anthony Rizzo catching a homer in the bleachers as part of the 2016 reunion. This is the second time this season that Anthony Rizzo has caught a home run in the bleachers. Jordan, you and I often talk about moments that make us believe in a higher power because they are too fantastical to be coincidence. We often speak about the D. Gordon home run after Jose Fernandez passed away as like, there's got to be someone up there. Has to be. Anthony Rizzo catching 2 home runs in the bleachers in the same season to me is there has to be a God. I don't know what the God looks like, but there's something up above.
Was there another one, or are we talking about the Ballesteros one? Because that was last season. Just clarifying. Did I miss
the point
third
stands.
Time that this happened? Okay. No, I was like, I started to believe it. But yes, if you didn't miss it, if you did miss the Ballesteros one last year and then Michael Busch on Saturday. It seemed like they were having a good time. Those Cubs. 10 years ago. 10 years ago.
Man.
Oh, God. It's a long time. All right. We're done. Thank you all for listening to this Monday edition of Baseball Barbacast. Hoping to maybe have a special guest on later this week. We'll try to nail that down. Get that sorted. But until then, thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Hope everyone enjoyed the baseball over the weekend as we barrel towards that trade deadline in 2 weeks. You can email us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. We will talk to you all on Wednesday.